The Guardian.
Hello, this is Science Weekly. I'm Alok Jha. On the show this week,
my very favourite extinct mammal is called Androsarcus, and that was a cow but with teeth. Extraordinary.
Hunting cow. What did it eat?
Cow. Smaller things.
Smaller cows. Smaller cows without teeth. Zoologist Kate Jones is here to talk about a new initiative trying to track, trace and catalogue the diversity of mammals in a bid to save them. And
the research hasn't yet shown a clear link, but scientists believe that there could be a possible link between the fake and especially the substandard artesianate and the resistance of the parasites.
Malaria is one of those problems that never quite goes away. You think you've got it licked and it just keeps popping back up. One problem is the trade in counterfeit anti-malarial drugs. We examine the medical consequences. Also this week, we've got The Guardian science correspondent Ian Sample. He's here to discuss some exciting science news, including what to do if aliens land on Earth, and just how much exercise do you need to stay healthy? This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. Among the various environmental challenges we face, maintaining the Earth's biodiversity is one of the biggest. Since the beginning of life on Earth, species have come and gone. That's natural. But nowadays, they're going faster than ever before. How do we stop this destruction? Dr. Kate Jones is from the Institute of Zoology and is part of a global network of researchers who are trying to find some answers, for mammals at least. She thinks that to stop extinctions in the future, we need to look to the past. She's here to tell us more. Kate, welcome to the podcast. Can we start by just defining, zoologically speaking, what mammals actually are?
So mammals are a group of organisms. There are about 5,000 species. They're cut up into different subgroups of mammals. And they all suckle young. And so we've got mammary glands, so that's why it's called a mammal. And most of them give birth to live young, apart from a couple which are egg layers. So there are a couple of species which lay eggs.
The platypus being one
of those.
Exactly,
yes.
The weirdest mammal on Earth. But when did mammals first appear on Earth? Because we sort of think of the history of Earth and think of dinosaurs and all sorts of things. But when did mammals first appear?
Along with the dinosaurs. So they grew up with the dinosaurs. So about 200 million years ago, they were mammal. They kind of first diverged from mammal-like reptiles. But I think what really struck me when I started looking at the diversity and the evolution of mammals was that there have been these waves of diversification, of speciation, of forms and varieties of mammals over the millennia, so or over millions of years. So there have been really early mammals have been quite adapted to their lifestyle. So a lot of people traditionally thought that the early mammals were small and scared of dinosaurs and, you know,
lived in holes.
And, you know, like looked scared when the dinosaurs went past. But really they had this massive array of forms and varieties that they were completely adapted to their environment. So there are fossils that are, you know, I think it's about 150 million years old, which have got tails to, like beavers and things which flew, kind of gliding mammals which flew. So there are like these waves of adaptations and diversifications of mammals. So what we see now is just the very tip of the iceberg of what was. My very favourite extinct mammal, is called Androsarcus. And that was a cow, but with teeth. So it actually hunted. And I think that's absolutely extraordinary.
A hunting cow? What did it eat?
A hunting cow. Smaller things.
Smaller cows. Smaller cows without teeth. Blimey. I mean, the actual one of the things that's interesting about this rearrangement of the tree of mammals is that you get really surprising examples of what's related to what more closely. So, I mean, it might surprise people to know that whales and dolphins and cows and sheep are more related than you might think. How are those things related?
Okay, well, back in the olden days when we didn't have genes and you couldn't take it down to the...
We didn't have genes.
Or we didn't know about genes. We didn't have the technology to do sequencing, our understanding about the evolutionary relationships of mammals was based on morphology. So thinking like measuring skulls or teeth or limbs or eye sockets to see how similar things were. And then that was kind of scored. And then you could recreate the phylogeny or evolutionary relationships based on that. Now, I've just told you that mammals are extraordinarily diverse and they adapt. They're kind of like bits of plasticine that adapt to each environment they're in. And there's been rapid parallel convergent evolution has gone on in the history of mammals. So even the ancient mammals, which look like beavers, that beaver tails, they're not in any way related to the beavers that we have now. So there's been this rapid turnover in morphologies. So using morphology to trace back through evolutionary time is not going to work for mammals. And so this is what our understanding of evolutionary relationships was based on in the past, was how similar things are. So when you've got massive convergent evolution going on in the bits of the tree, you can't use morphology, you have to use genes. And so in the recent 5 to 10 years, has been a massive revolution of our understanding of mammal phylogeny, because things like the Artiodactyla, which are the sheep and the cows, are sister taxa, sister species to dolphins and whales. So they used to be in two orders. So one was Cetacea, which is the whales and dolphins, and Artiodactyla, which is the cows and the sheep. So now they're called Cetartiodactyla because they're actually so similar that they're in the same order. So an order of mammals is like primates like us or bats. So that's how similar they are to each other. So it acts absolutely extraordinary that a hoof can turn it into a fin in, you know, tens of thousands of years. It's absolutely extraordinary.
Now, that is extraordinary. But I mean, I suppose one of the sadder parts of the last 100 years or so has been that mammals, as charismatic and beautiful as they are, they're in large parts are dying out around the world. And you edited a special edition of the Philosophical Transactions of the Royal Society, looking at the problems of conservation of mammals into the future. So can you just give us a picture of what the state of mammals today is? Given this amazing history you've talked about and this diversity, what's the state of them all now?
So about 1 in 5 mammal species is threatened with extinction. That means they're either critically endangered, or vulnerable. So, you know, 1 in 5 species is more likelihood of extinction in 50 years. And some areas are more threatened than others. So that's where you have high levels of deforestation and high levels of human use of landscapes. So that's the kind of status that we have at the moment. And there's also not just species which are endangered, but species which have got a unique evolutionary history as well. So there's not just the red list of endangered species, but there's the EDGE list of mammal species. And the EDGE stands for evolutionary distinct and globally endangered. So it puts a kind of measure of distinctiveness on them. So we used our tree of all the species of mammals to put together an EDGE list of these mammals. So these are ones which are endangered but are unique. So they're the only species in its entire family. They don't have any close relatives whatsoever. And so that's just an added measure of distinctiveness, and like Mona Lisa or like
painting. You'd lose an entire genetic lineage.
Absolutely. So that's just another way to kind of prioritize our conservation efforts. So that's how we, you know, it's a way of prioritizing what we're going, how to save them in the future.
In your in the edition of the journal that you edited, you talk about how to actually put together plans to conserve the more endangered animals. You've had problems in the past because you've not got enough data. Can you just take us through that and how will you fix that problem?
About 10 years ago, a group of us got together with a couple of research grants and to look at trying to predict which mammals would go extinct and why, and which areas were more endangered. So we have this red list, which gives us lists of species and their assessments of their population. But we have no formalized model of how that happens, like which are some biological traits predispose you to extinction, or are some areas more important than others, or some phylogenetic history, is that important in determining how likely you are to go extinct? And does it vary with distinct drivers of extinction, so hunting or deforestation? And we didn't have any clue about how that could be done formally. So we got together a big international team to try to think about, well, how are we going to answer that question? So firstly, you need traits of all the mammals. You know, you need to know their life history strategies, like how many babies they have, or how big they are, or how long they live. And then we need to know where they live, so what their geographic range size is, and whereabouts they live, and how wide they range, and what their population density is. And then we also need to know their evolutionary history, so we need to understand how they're related to each other as well. So we basically had to build these databases from scratch for over 5,000 species, which is a big deal. So trying to get all the geographic range, traits, and all the trees of all mammals. So this has taken us over 10 years to actually pull all this together. And now we've got this amazing resource that we can use to predict species extinctions in mammals. So we've got a better idea of which ones and where the future battlegrounds will be. So after we did all of those studies and put those data together, the special issue is really celebrating that we've got all of these data now, and we can actually start to really try and understand the processes driving biodiversity of mammals. So why are there so many species in the tropics? You know, what are the processes? What are the drivers of those things? So the special issue is a kind of first look at evolution of mammals on a global scale with a spatial life history and phylogenetic component to it. And I think it's really special.
So what do you predict in terms of the number of species that might go extinct in the next century or so? And how do we prevent that?
It really depends on the scenarios that you use. So you can't, it's more about the scenario approach to extinction. So that if you have an association of species ranges with a different climate, say, and the climate then is predicted to change under one of the models from the IPCC, then what you can then do is work out how species are going to change their ranges. And if there are ranges to change into, maybe it's taken over by a city, so you can't actually move to that area because it's already blocked. So I'm not giving you a straight answer because it's more of a scenario approach that we take.
There's an interesting project you're involved in, try and get people involved in conservation. Can you tell us a bit about that?
So maybe backtrack slightly, and that's one of the key findings of this putting this special issue together was that we hardly know anything about the whole ecosystems of mammals. So we hardly know anything about how the abundances of different organisms within the same ecosystem. And with birds, it's very easy to do that because you can monitor all the birds with one technique. But with mammals, because they're so different, you have to have different monitoring techniques for different groups of mammals. So for bats, you might use an acoustic survey. For shrews, you'd have to trap them at night. For monkeys, you'd have to go around watching them in the trees. So there's a whole different suite of things that you need to know about. And our models have been showing that we don't know enough about these ecosystems, and we don't know enough to build these really big models of understanding biodiversity and what the processes are. And so that to really try to understand and pick apart these processes to be able to conserve them into the future, we need much more information about what species are present, how they're declining, how they fit into an ecosystem, what ecosystem services they're preventing. So that's a very long answer to what I've done. And that is a tool which people can use. Everyday people that like bats, they can start to monitor bats in their area. So we've set up a global bat monitoring program called iBats, so it's Indicator Bats Program. And what we've done is created a bat app called the iBats app. And so you can have it on your smartphone and then plug in an ultrasonic microphone into the phone. And then you can switch it on and then record the bats that are in your area along a set transect. And then you can upload it to the website and then we can analyse it using
otters. You can use that information to actually form a map of how many bats there are in those places.
And we've been doing this in about 16 countries in the world, and latest ones have been in Russia, which is a brilliant place to do a bat monitoring programme. They're brilliant, really friendly people. And some of them are a little bit paranoid that we're actually monitoring them using the bat, the bat boxes. So...
That's a different problem.
That's a different problem.
Conservation is not going to solve that particular problem. Kate, thank you very much for that. Yeah, now you're going to stay with us for our news section, but if any of our listeners want to investigate your research, what's the web address we should point them to?
If you look at the IBATS website, that's a good start, or my personal webpage to look at the papers and to get a copy of the Phil Trams issue if they want.
And we can link to all of that on our blog too, but the Institute of Zoology website also is zsl.org. Joining us in the studio to take a look at this week's science news is the one mammal that we hope never faces an extinction event. He's the Guardian Science primate, Ian Sample. And of course, Kate Jones is still with us. This week, we'll be looking at corals to start with. Kate, this is your story. Corals are in trouble all over the world. What's happening to them this week?
Basically, corals are in massive decline across the planet. They're one of the most endangered organisms we have. And increasingly because of global warming. So this study, they found this direct link between human poo, basically, and this coral disease. So before, they'd had this kind of associated evidence, which wasn't enough to change any behaviour of the authorities. And so now they've done the genetics and they've actually linked the strains in human poo to actually the diseases in the pathogen in the corals.
Is this just a case of better sewage and sanitation from is that what's needed to sort of fix this problem? It seems like a fairly straightforward thing.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's just a lack of investment in sewage treatment works.
What I liked about this study was actually that not only do they find the bacterium that's responsible for this, that they actually go on to suggest very real life solutions for it, and some which have actually already been proven to work. So in Key West, they've said they've not seen a new case of white pox since they moved to a more advanced wastewater treatment facility in 2001. And what they're saying here is that if you can encourage communities around the world where this white pox is a problem to get away from septic tanks to more impressive, sort of more modern sewage treatment works, it looks like you could save some of these corals that are dying from that pox.
Corals are one of those species that that we're always writing about in terms of how damaged they are, how damaged they're becoming, and the sort of thing on the horizon is climate change, of course, and ocean acidification, these things that actually are damaging corals all over the world. And I think, Kate, some of your colleagues at the Zoological Society have set up a project to specifically look at evolutionarily diverse corals around the world. It's another EDGE project, I believe.
Yeah, so we've put together a phylogeny, or estimated a evolutionary history of corals, and tried to figure out which ones are the most distinct, which ones, if we lost them, we'd lose a whole section of the tree of life. So it's just another way of prioritising different species, because we can't, you know, that we've got finite resources, you can't save everything. So trying to prioritise which corals are most important and most distinct. So there's the top 10 EDGE corals, which EDGE species, which we've highlighted. We're trying to put measures in place to try to protect them.
And actually, if you want to read about the EDGE project, we can put a link on our website. But also there's a news story we wrote back in January about the EDGE corals project. Let's move on now to the benefits of exercise. Now, there was a study published in The Lancet last week looking at the effects of exercise on health. Now, this is obvious. People know doing exercise is good for you. What medics didn't really know or have a number on was whether even small amounts of exercise are good for you. So the usual sort of health advice is try and get several hours over the course of a week, walking or whatever, even light exercise. And so what these guys in Taiwan did was to look at a long-term prospective study over 8 years of more than 400,000 people. They categorized them all into different levels of activity, from inactive, basically sitting on your sofa all day long, to highly active, I don't know, running marathons or something. And they found that the category that was just above inactive, so just moderately active, that's 15 minutes per day, an hour and a half in total all week, that can actually reduce your mortality risk by 14% overall and increases your lifespan by 3 years. And for every 15 minutes extra of exercise that you do every day, your mortality risk reduces by 4% and cancers by 1%, which shows that even a small amount of exercise, just walking in to work or getting off at the bus stop one bus stop earlier or something, walking in, can actually have quite long, large effects. I'm assuming that this means you have to do this every day and it builds up. Not just doing one 15-minute walk is going to make much difference to your life. But it shows that even small amounts can be beneficial.
I think it's also important where you do it too. So it's not just 15 minutes in your house, but you could go for a walk in the woods and or a green space. And there's been lots of other studies which have shown that depression rates actually decrease if you're outside and you can exercise outside or spend time outside. And this is one of the benefits of biodiversity or wild nature that people have been trying to quantify in some way.
What I thought was interesting about this study was something actually that they don't really go into in it, which is what mechanism is at work here, or what mechanisms are at work here for the different conditions that they're looking at. So if you think that there is a reasonably well understood mechanism whereby exercise will reduce your risk of cardiovascular diseases and things like that, but when it comes to cancers and so on, what the relationship between mild exercise and cancer risk, I think, is very interesting. Now, you know that if you have a lot of body fat, that can change your hormonal balances, and those can and do lead to increases in certain types of cancer. But I think in this case, we're talking about, you know, really moderate amounts of exercise. And I'm not sure if it's the same mechanism. I'm not sure if they're talking about actually it's your improvement or you're better off in terms of cancer risk because you're reducing your body fat, or if there's something else going on. And I think that is really the interesting question out of this study for me.
Yeah, I agree. I think that is interesting because this whole thing has been about obesity and obesity reduction. And actually, maybe it isn't about that. Maybe it's something else. I think that's really
It could be down to the fact that if you're more likely to get 15 minutes of exercise a day, you're more likely to be slightly less stressed generally.
Maybe, you which want again, to go out. Might be mental.
Yeah, you make the effort to go outside and do something else for 15 minutes a day rather than just sit at your desk and be angry at the world or something.
And you might be grabbing fewer fast food meals because you're running around. Exactly, all of this stuff, you know, and you'd hope that, you know, to some extent you would try and control for this stuff, but that stuff is actually really hard to control for.
But the message is, you know, do your 15 minutes.
Did you do your 15 minutes?
I walked into work this morning.
Did you?
Actually, yeah. No. And most of the work this week. So it's 35 minutes most days. I've been, I don't want to go into my exercise habits here, but let me just say, ever since I did body pump 2 weeks ago, I've been afraid to go to the gym. Everything hurts. Okay, we're going to move on to something slightly less ridiculous. More ridiculous. What am I talking about? So, Ian, it's the silly season. The politicians are on holiday. Nothing really is happening apart from the riots. You've come in heroically with a story.
Thank you.
To save the newspaper about aliens. Now, this is a question that we probably all have. We all want to meet aliens, probably. But what happens if they turn up? What's the scenario?
I think now and then in our field of work, if you can call it work, a paper comes along that you have to fully embrace, no matter how cautious you may feel about doing that or how aware of the backlash that is likely from writing about it. And this was one of those papers that I enthusiastically embraced. It was a study by some guys at Penn State University, and the lead author was part of a group, a NASA-affiliated group, the Planetary Sciences Division, where they had actually said, look, let's just look at the various scenarios that could plausibly happen, or that maybe implausibly could happen, if there is, at some future points, contact between humans and extraterrestrial intelligences. Now, I should say, first of all, there's been some confusion over this study about whether or not it was funded by NASA. It wasn't funded by NASA, even though one of the guys is involved with NASA. It was kind of a sideline project they did for a bit of interest. Now, what I like about the study is what they've done is they've looked through, will contact, if it happens, be beneficial to humanity, neutral, or detrimental. And then they've worked through as many scenarios as they can dream up in each of those three categories. And I think they come up with some really interesting and fun stuff.
So what give me an example of these types of contact.
I like the eat one. That one's quite good.
Yeah, well, so on the negative side.
On the negative side. If they eat us, that's definitely,
that definitely a negative, not a good,
yeah. A negative contact if they
yeah,
eat us.
Yeah, there is. Right. There is
that seems fairly obvious.
You don't need to look far into any
these
kind
people
of
have degrees, yes?
Fiction or non-fiction literature to see that the assumption of any extraterrestrial intelligence, by very fact of it getting in touch with us and trying to, you know, have some kind of discussion, the assumption is that it might be more advanced than we are, and thereby crush us like a bug in a fight if it should choose to do so. Now, you know, they are saying, you know, going through the different scenarios, maybe there are, like us, some pretty selfish beings out there who sort of make sure they're top dog and at the expense of everything else. And so why would they treat us any differently? They may want to come here and use our resources, you know, do lots of negative things that we wouldn't be particularly chuffed about. But, you know, on the plus side, the study also goes through positive encounters. You know, even to detection itself maybe would be interesting for a lot of people philosophically, even if we can never get in touch with them and we just know that they are bugs that are living and we only detect them from gases in the atmosphere. But there's all sorts of lovely scenarios in here. One thing I thought was particularly interesting is they were saying that we may want to avoid, when we're sending signals out into space, to avoid giving too much information on our biological makeup, because a sort of maligned extraterrestrial intelligence might use that information to develop a sort of biological weapon that targets humans that could be visited on us in the future. Another thing which I thought was...
This assumes they're watching like the BBC Four and that kind of thing, doesn't it?
Or even intentional signals that we send out to space, like signals that we might send but out we're not saying, we're here, we have this
not,
sort of DNA.
But we're not sending our DNA code into space, are we? What we're sending into space is Kevin Fong or Adam Rutherford talking about cells and genetics. And, you know, as detailed as they are, that's not going to allow any life form to build a copy. Can you imagine?
Yeah, but you have to bear in mind that, you know, certain broadcasts will only go so far. And to do a signal to ET, you might choose a different wavelength, different frequency to the ones that our TV broadcasts go out, because obviously they're for different tasks. So an actual intentional signal that we send out to say, hello, is anybody out there, would probably be at a different frequency than you would send a TV broadcast. TV broadcasts have gone far enough since the 1950s to reach about 100 light years away from Earth. So those poor bastards, if I can say that, will be seeing all sorts of terrible telly and radio from back in those
days.
This
is true. I mean, the thing is, the question I have is that these things you say might attract people, other species to our planet, but would Big Brother, after watching Big Brother, would they want to come and visit the Earth?
This is absolutely one of the scenarios they talk about. They say that there is, you know, they go through everything, and let's not
let's not diss them for that.
I think that this is actually, you know, it's very easy to attack, but it's fun and it's interesting and
attacking.
It makes you think about this
what
stuff.
What about this thing about, you know, aliens may destroy humanity to protect our, you know, other civilizations? What about
this was really good fun. I mean, they're saying there's two sort of scenarios whereby they say that they entertain this idea. The first being that there's a vast assumption in there being an extraterrestrial intelligence within kind of giving a toss distance of Earth. And what if they decide that, like here on Earth, any species that is rapidly expanding tends to do so at the detriment to all the other species around it? And they may decide that a rapidly expanding civilization and one that's starting to poke about in space and all that is best nipped in the bud, according to this report. And so they may actually just decide, say, well, look, you know what, as soon as these guys get off their planet and start marauding around the universe, they're going to be a bit of a problem, so we may as well swap them while we can.
There is one question which I thought was quite relevant to what we were talking about earlier with mammals, which is that one of the scenarios, one of the ideas might be that if even a benevolent species of alien comes along and says, hello, I've got light speed travel for you and lasers and lightsabers and stuff like that, work with me here, and they happen to be more advanced than us and all of that, we contract a virus or they push us out of our natural range, it goes right back to what we're doing to everything else on this planet. So why is that such a strange idea?
Yeah, I agree. That is a really interesting arc. So, you know, with the coral story, we gave a pathogen that was from us into coral species, and aliens could give a pathogen in them right to us and do exactly the same thing.
We could just become one of those mammals that is becoming extinct. Ian?
Although the chances are, I mean, we have to, you know, hit that one, is that it's easy, relatively easy for us to do this on Earth and for us to get infected by microbes and viruses carried by animals, because we all evolved in the same place, basically. But microbes coming from, you know, if there are microbes on other planets and they end up here, chances are, you know, they will have evolved in such wildly different environments to anything here that there may be just a biological firewall in between the two. There's no reason to think that any bug from another planet would do anything to us, because we would be so alien to it.
When Stephen Hawking was talking about all this stuff last year to promote his latest Discovery TV series, Paul Davis, the acclaimed astrophysicist, sort of agreed with him, saying, yeah, we shouldn't send stuff out into space in case. But if you speak to the guys actually at SETI, the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence over in California, they're more sanguine about the whole thing. They're saying, look, aliens won't learn anything from watching The Goon Show or any other TV broadcasts. And the fact is, we've been doing it, so there's nothing to stop us from doing it anyway. We'll gain nothing from stopping them. And if an alien species could find us, then the fact that they've watched a few broadcasts is not going to make any difference to them doing whatever they wanted with us. But having said all that, Paul Davis is actually on a committee, a world committee, called the Post-Detection Task Force.
Yeah, I saw that.
Which is the SETI's so he is determining...
He's actually responsible for responding if alien contact...
That's right. He's responsible for working out the response, the global response.
But he actually can... He's allowed to stand up there and be the response.
That's right. That's right. There you go. And with that, we'll finish this news section. If you want to read about more of any of that sort of stuff, you can go to guardian.co.uk/science, where you can also comment on Ian's story, 500 comments and counting at the moment. And just don't say that NASA's a waste of money. It's that NASA didn't even fund this project.
And now the Hanford question.
My name's John Bradshaw. I'm the author of In Defence of Dogs, and I'm from the University of Bristol. The science question that I'm most intrigued by, and which I'd most like an answer to, is the biology of consciousness. What is consciousness? How does it work? And does it actually discriminate human beings from other species? Because I think that's one of the key issues in animal welfare and indeed in animal rights. If we're unique, then we should have a very different perception of animals around us. If consciousness is something that comes in shades of grey or different colours or whatever, then I think we have to take cognizance of the fact that other animals may be conscious, but in ways that we can't fully comprehend. So that's essentially why I want to know about consciousness.
Around half the world's population is exposed to malaria, and every year, nearly 1 million people die from this disease, which is spread by mosquitoes. There are drugs that can keep the malaria parasite at bay, but the bug is ever evolving, and every change reduces the effectiveness of the drugs we have. That ongoing battle is serious enough, but things get even worse in some malaria-ravaged parts of the world, where counterfeit drugs have enabled disease to spread faster than ever. It's even returning to areas where people thought they'd seen the back of the disease. Nisha Ligon is a journalist and filmmaker, and she's been investigating the problems that counterfeit drugs have brought to communities in Thailand. Fresh from a recent trip to the country, she spoke to Camilla Ruse about the dangers that counterfeit drugs can bring.
Yeah, so I was in both Thailand and Cambodia. My project's actually looking at anti-malarial drug resistance, so malaria that's becoming resistant to the drugs we're using. And the issue of the counterfeits was something that I sort of ran into with the research there. People believe that it might be somewhat linked, that there could be a link between this huge problem that they have with counterfeit anti-malarials and the resistance that's developing to the drugs. One of the places I went to was a town called Massot on the Thai-Burma border. It's a really interesting place because it's mostly Burmese people in the city, but it's a city in Thailand, and it's one of the areas where they're starting to worry that anti-malarial drug resistance to the drug artemisinin, which is sort of our best drug that we currently have to treat malaria, that this is beginning to emerge, When the people are treated with the drug, it's taking much longer for the parasites to clear. And so it hasn't yet been confirmed as resistance yet. The resistance has only been confirmed in one area in Western Cambodia, but the worry is that it may have spread here now to the Thai-Burma border. And so I went there and I talked to some really interesting people about this and issues of malaria in general.
And there was a report in April, wasn't there, by the CDC? Is that right? About malaria having spread to the Thai-Burma border?
Well, there was a report, actually. The CDC did a study in northern Burma, but that wasn't confirming resistance. Again, all they're seeing right now is that the drugs are taking longer for the parasites to clear. And that's how it started. That's what they first saw in Cambodia. And so now the Shoklo Malaria Research Unit, which is based on in the border area there, is they've also seen this delayed clearance time. So now they're continuing to do studies, and hopefully they think maybe by October they'll know whether or not they can confirm that this is actually what they are seeing. But the signs seem worrying right now, and most of the researchers I spoke to said, you know, it does seem to be the beginning of resistance.
Now, you spoke to a lot of people who live there and have to sort of deal with malaria and have to deal with the fake drugs all the time. And you spoke to one person in particular who had a really dramatic story.
Yeah, so I met a guy named Thiha Yarzar. He was an ex-political prisoner from Burma. I actually went to him because I'd heard he could help me with some translation and that he had good connections with the media in the area. But, you know, I was asking him about these fake anti-malarials. Have you ever, you know, heard of someone taking a fake artemisinin-based drug? The main one in the area is artesunate. And he was like, yeah, I think I actually took one myself. And he proceeded to tell me this pretty shocking story about having malaria when back in prison in Burma.
When I was in Kalib prison, the whole area is still malaria area, a terrible area. So I was there for 4 years and I got malaria 13 times, 3-0. And they hospitalized me 7 times. So the doctor gave me artemether and artesunate. In it, some are genuine medication, some are fake. They are doing this very systematically. Even the doctor cannot distinguish which is fake, which is genuine. Finally, the patients, including me, we were afraid of taking malaria medication. And in front of me, lots of people died. One political prisoner, my friends, died in prison, died of malaria. We are suffering from malaria. At the same time, if we take fake pee, can be died easily.
Yeah, that is a very shocking story, what we've just heard. So did you speak to anybody who could explain a little bit more about the science or the fake drugs themselves?
Yeah, so one of the real experts in this is Dr. Paul Newton. He's a doctor from Oxford, but he's based in Laos, and he's been monitoring the quality of specifically artesunate, one of these artemisinin-based drugs, in Southeast Asia for about a decade now. And they found some pretty shocking numbers. In the early 2000s, they found that between a third and one half of all of the store-bought artesunate was either complete fakes or contained too little of the active ingredient to cure a patient. He's also collaborated on a really pretty amazing project that brought together the WHO, Interpol, and researchers and public health officials from all around the region to try and track where these fake drugs are coming from. And they did a forensic analysis of the pills themselves. When you manufacture something, pollen spores are trapped in it. And so they were able to look at the pollen spores and the different varieties of trees that produce that pollen and found that that combination of different trees only occurs in a certain area of southern China. They also found traces of calcite in the pills, which is, it's a type of calcite that has a signature that's mined only in, again, a certain area of southern China. So they went to the area near that, by that mine, and actually there was a factory there producing fake anti-malarials, and the Chinese government went in and shut it down. So it's a pretty, you know, amazing cooperation there to get things done. But it seems that there's still other routes that the drugs are going through, and that though good things are being done to deal with the problem, it's still a major issue. And they've also been seeing these fake drugs as far as Africa. There have been some found in Ghana now. And the problem is if we don't look, we don't really know where they are. So the scale of the problem isn't yet clear, but we know it's big.
The sort of the general idea about fakes is that they can just contain chalk. But the work by the chemists involved in the project, Mike Green from CDC and Facundo Fernandez from Georgia Tech, demonstrated that they contain a rather bewildering array of wrong active ingredients, which was really very unexpected. We just imagined that they would be like inert chalk. But no, they contain a whole range of diverse antibiotics and antimalarials, including some banned precursors of ecstasy. But the diversity of wrong active ingredients was quite bewildering at first and a surprise. But it also has health implications in that if people had allergies to these medicines, or if these medicines gave people side effects, then they could be potentially harmful. Like if you were allergic to erythromycin, you may get bad consequences because the medicine didn't contain artesunate, but it did contain erythromycin.
So Paul Newton was just telling us that the drugs, the fake drugs, could also be giving people allergic reactions. So they could be even more harmful than what was previously thought.
Yeah, so you would think, you know, these counterfeit drug manufacturers would just put chalk or flour into these pills, but it seems they're actually putting in substances that could be very harmful. And I think that sometimes patients don't realize that because a lot of antimalarials, especially quinine in the past, had some pretty strong side effects. So if someone takes the drug that's a counterfeit and it has some kind of active ingredient, but that's not a malaria cure, it could be causing reactions that they think, oh, this is just a side effect, but it could actually be a very dangerous reaction. And the problem is we just really don't know, because if we're not monitoring the quality of the drugs, a patient who gets very ill or dies, you know, it might just be attributed to malaria. And we don't realize that, oh no, it's because the drugs weren't working or even they were having a harmful effect.
Okay, so these fake drugs of the last real big malaria drug that we have, what is the main worry that the scientists are thinking about?
So as I mentioned before, they're already beginning to detect resistance to this artemisinin class of drugs. And the research hasn't yet shown a clear link, but scientists believe that there could be a possible link between the fake and especially the substandard artesunate and the resistance of the parasite. So the idea is if you're taking these drugs that contain a small amount of the active ingredient, but not enough to cure someone, you're exposing the malaria parasites to the drug, killing off only the ones that are most sensitive and leaving the ones that are most tolerant. So essentially you're breeding these more tolerant parasites in your blood, and then that might continue to spread. And so essentially it's laying the groundwork for resistance to emerge because it's allowing the parasites to adapt to the drug without killing them.
Many thanks to Nisha Ligon there. That's all we have for this edition of Science Weekly. Thanks to our special guest, Kate Taylor, and also The Guardian's Ian Sample. You can keep up to speed with breaking science news at any time, of course, on guardian.co.uk/science. But from me, Alok Jha, and Science Weekly producer Jason Phipps, it's goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.